Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined as always by JC Abbott. JC, how are you doing today?
Wow, I'm not sure I deserved all of that excitement, Hodge. I'm fired up for my own name. Like, that felt like a WWE entrance or something like that.
I was taking a leaf out of my boy Adam Goss's book in introducing you. Adam Goss, of course, the in-house announcer for the Toronto Argonauts, who does a great job. Bob McGregor does a great job in Winnipeg as well. Shout out stadium announcers. That's got to be one of the most fun jobs, I think, in professional sports. Justin Dunk is away for personal reasons. We're hopeful he'll be back next week. Just wanted to get that off the top in case any listeners, viewers were wondering where Justin is. We expect he will be back as soon as he is done dealing with a personal matter. Today, we're discussing the CFL's two Alberta-based teams getting impressive upset wins.
The Toronto Argonauts hitting rock bottom in the Three Down Nation power rankings.
Ouch. A truncated Week 6 schedule.
The CFL permanently publicizing negotiations lists. Hallelujah!
A CFL fan winning $1 million this past weekend.
And Sean Lemon potentially making a return to the CFL. But first,
Saturday's games between the BC Lions and Montreal Alouettes ended in a brawl. JC, we got a brawl. We got a beatdown. You covered this game remotely, though Three Down Nation reporter Pablo Herrera-Varguera was there on the scene and had his own video of the incident if you'd like to watch it on his social media feeds. JC, how did this whole mess occur, and do you think it was a black eye on the CFL?
Well, I'll start with the second half of the question, and yes, it was a black eye on the CFL. It's always a black eye on the league and on the teams involved when something like this occurs, and it seems like we get one of these every couple of years where there's a real incident like this. It's always ugly, and it's never a good look. I'm sure we'll get into the discussion on the punishment, but somebody has to come down hard on this so it doesn't happen again. In terms of the logistics of what occurred, there's two differing sides to this story. On the Montreal Alouettes half, they say that Kamoko Touré, the BC Lions defensive end, who was a former second-round NFL draft pick, attempted to enter their locker room post-game and was screaming profanities, at which point Isaac Aguiemi-Berglund, the Alouettes defensive lineman, got involved, told him to leave, and then things got physical, punches were thrown, and the brawl ensued. According to Touré, who contacted Three Down Nation through the BC Lions staff via a statement, he said that he was just talking to a buddy, Jamar McGloster, the offensive tackle for the Alouettes, and then he was essentially accosted, and it was the Alouettes who cranked up the volume on the situation and started the fight. Now, there's pretty clear video of what preceded this. Touré's at the mouth of the Alouettes locker room, and whether he was there to scream and shout and flex his muscles, or he was there to say hello to McGloster, he shouldn't have been there, right? You can't go through another team's bench and be in their locker room area, especially after a heated football game like that one was that ends on the final play. That's a dumb decision, and I think that's ultimately what's going to cost him in terms of the punishment.
I thought you did a great job breaking that down, JC. And there was some lead up even in the late stages of the game, right? A very, very pivotal call late in that game when the BC Lions kicked, pardon me, the Montreal Alouettes kicked what may have been a game-winning field goal. Was Pierre-Olivier Lestage and a couple members of that BC team were jockeying, and it looked like there might have been kind of an instigating hit, and then Pierre-Olivier Lestage retaliated, and he was the one who got flagged. He also appeared to push, not hard, but still pushed a TSN camera on the bench. I'm sure he's going to face some supplemental discipline for that. And of course, that penalty was part of what allowed the BC Lions to move down the field so quickly, because of course the Alouettes had to kick 15 yards back from the normal spot where you're kicking off. Like, they're kicking off almost in the shadow of their own goalposts when all you need is a field goal, right? From Sean White to win it if you're BC. That's a hugely impactful part. So Obviously, temperatures were rising. Personally, I'm shocked. Shocked, I say, that the BC Lions are blaming the Alouettes and the Alouettes are blaming the BC Lions. I couldn't have imagined that possibly taking place. Truly a revelation there. But on a more serious note, I'm kind of two minds on this. On the one hand, the CFL, like all professional organizations, likes to wrap itself in a blanket of community and family and togetherness and inclusion. And very obviously, players literally physically fighting each other flies in the face of that, right? We will never see that clip on a CFL commercial with some type of soft voiceover that's like, and family and togetherness, right? Like that's not going to happen. But at the same time, there are a ton of media outlets across this continent, a lot of which are in the United States of America, who will never in a million years write a story entitled CFL Teams Play Well, Put On Great Game. Like that article just will never get written. That story will never make its way to the nooks and crannies of the country south of the border. The only way for the CFL to get attention, right, internationally, is for something wild to happen, like somebody winning $1 million or a fight breaking out post game. Should it be that way? Preferably not. In a perfect world, everybody would in the news be able to disseminate stories that are literally just, hey, great teams play great game. But unfortunately, that's not how the world works. It's never how the world has worked, and it's never how the world will work in the future. The brawl will get this league attention, and I'm sure there were dozens of articles and a ton. Like I saw it all over my feeds. Video of that fight went at least semi-viral, if not viral. And in a way, for a league that needs as many eyeballs as possible, there is some positive to that. So again, I'm loath to say it's a black mark on the CFL because of that. I also don't think it's necessarily a huge green flag on the CFL, but I think there's some good and some bad. It's maybe a bit of a gray area. On the one hand, no exposure is bad exposure. On the other hand, this is, for obvious reasons, not what the CFL wants to set itself as. And I'm very interested to see what Commissioner Stuart Johnston will do, right? The very first thing he said in his very first press conference was, number one is integrity of the game. Well, fair. The game was done when this incident happened. But I still think players actively fist fighting on the sideline is something that has to do with the integrity of the game. So I'm curious to see how hard he chooses to slap these players in the pocketbook for participating in this. We might even see a suspension. Who knows? It's a new world with a new commissioner. So I'm interested to see how this plays out.
I disagree with your premise, Hodge, that any press is good press, because I've had my feed flooded with the same videos and commentary that you have in terms of this brawl, and not a single one of them reflected the CFL in a respectful or positive light. I don't think you gain anything from that type of exposure that just continues to fuel some sort of Bush League narrative around the CFL. I think it's actually more harmful than it is helpful in the American market to have yourself painted in this manner. And to your point, the only way to counteract that is to send a strong message with the punishment. And I really believe that there has to be suspensions handed out here, certainly for Touré. And unless there's compelling evidence by Isaac Adeyemi Berglund that he was actually physically defending someone in that locker room, then he should be suspended as well as whoever the practice roster player was, who obviously wasn't wearing a jersey, so we couldn't identify him, who flew in afterwards and I believe may have actually landed the either first or second punch of that altercation. All of those players should be suspended by the league in my mind with the evidence that we currently have in front of us, and that will send a statement that this is unacceptable and that this commissioner is going to take player discipline seriously and build off the precedent that's been set by Randy Ambrosi. Now, the other person who needs to put their foot down here, Hodge, is BC Lions head coach Buck Pierce, because this has become a problem for the Lions. And yes, this brawl is a little bit of a different category than what came before, but they had 146 yards of penalties in that game. They were terrible with penalties the week before, and more important than just the on-field lack of discipline, this is now the third week, Hodge, that they're going to have a player punished in some capacity for committing non-football acts. You go 2 weeks ago against Winnipeg, it was Corey Woodruff, the offensive lineman who was going after Willie Jefferson and almost knocked out an official, got ejected from that game and later fined. And then last week, late in the fourth quarter, Chris Sluger and Anu Una got into it with the Saskatchewan defensive line. There was some pushing and shoving, some punches thrown in that pile, and both of them received fines, as well as two Saskatchewan defensive linemen for that incident. So this has become a trend, escalating week after week, that the BC Lions are going to engage in stuff after the whistle, after the game. They're going to take undisciplined penalties. As a first-time head coach, you cannot let this continue to escalate and build momentum and become the identity of your team. You have to make a statement now, and you have to send a message that this isn't going to be acceptable, because it's ultimately going to cost you games at some point.
Yeah, I just brought up the penalty listings. BC is, to their credit, in the middle of these rankings. Coming into this past week, they were taking seven penalties a game for an average of 60.8 yards. Again, both middle of the pack. But I do get where you're coming from, JC. The nature of these penalties has been a little different than some of the other teams in the CFL. And after this week, they will presumably jump up these rankings at least a little bit. We don't have the official numbers for CFL stats through week five. We'll get those presumably on Tuesday, recording this Monday as always. I will push back on what you said about the black mark. Like, I think the black mark is domestically, right? Like people in Canada know what the CFL is. I think they have a pretty good understanding of what it is. For some people, it's their favorite league in the whole wide world, and that will never change. For some people, it's just kind of something fun to have on in the summertime. And maybe you watch the Grey Cup too. And for some people, it's like, yeah, I'm not really interested in watching that. And there's not really anything that can change that. And that's fine. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. What I'm more talking about is in the States, right? There are millions of Americans who don't even know that the CFL exists, and their idea of maybe a really fun Friday night is putting on this weird Canadian league where apparently they fight each other every game. Now, obviously, we don't fight each other every game in this league, but if you're an American,
that type of marketing worked really well for the XFL.
Well, if they get one piece of CFL news or information for the entire year, and it's a brawl, then I don't think it's completely ridiculous to draw the conclusion that, oh, apparently these crazy Canadians who always fight in hockey love to fight in football too. And they might tune in. And I appreciate that, yeah, the XFL was not successful. Fair enough. But the XFL had the U.S. as a primary market. The CFL needs the U.S. as a secondary market. And those are two very different things. So I don't think it was a good look for the CFL domestically. But internationally, like, at a certain point, I think it's good to just remind people that you literally exist, because there are lots of Americans who are even football fans. They watch the NFL. They watch college. And they don't know that the CFL exists. And I don't think that it's a bad thing that they might be scrolling through their feed, be it on TikTok or be it on Twitter, be it on Instagram, wherever they like to get their content, their news, their whatever you want to call it. I don't think it's a bad thing if a CFL play comes across their page, even if it's a post-game brawl.
I think we'd be remiss in not talking about maybe the element that makes these sorts of incidents possible, Hodge, before we move on. And that's the fact that in places like Montreal and most of the East Division stadiums, even in BC, the benches are on the same side, right? So these teams are really close together. It's not as if Kamoko Touré walked all the way across the 65-yard field through the Alouettes bench and then went into the locker room. He just had to move slightly down the sideline, sneak in behind the crowd, and get into that position. And I think if you talk to officials, if you talk to people who have to manage that sort of things, that it is a challenge in the CFL when you've got professional athletes with their blood up, guys who are smashing and crashing between the whistles, and then you're putting them mere feet from each other for the entire game, stuff is going to kick off occasionally. And I really wish the CFL would do more to address that underlying issue. I believe part of the reason why teams are on the same side is because you can maximize advertising and then get that on the broadcast by having the cameras pointed away from the benches. I understand some of that financial side. There's also logistical challenges in certain stadiums. I would think Percival Molson would be one of those, given how old it is. Though I've been told that the McGill football team, which plays out of that stadium, is able to have their opponents on the opposite side from them when they play games there. So clearly it can be done with college rosters that are typically larger than CFL rosters. So there's no excuse there in terms of those logistics. If you want to stop these brawls, if you really want to be serious about it, you need to find ways to get teams on opposite sides, because until you do, it's going to keep happening with reasonable regularity, right? We see it once every couple years, once every year, that teams get into it after the whistle. Not necessarily to this extent. Sometimes it's in the parking lot, as we've seen before, but this can't keep happening.
Yeah, and I do think that even if you're entering and exiting, right, you can't change the infrastructure. Even if you're using the same entrance or the same exit, part of the problem is just being in that close proximity the entire game, mm-hmm. right? Like the game that I covered in Ottawa last year when the Saskatchewan Roughriders were in town, there was a big blow-up post-game. And the reason it happened was because, especially for the last few minutes of that game, there was a lot of jockeying and drama that took place between those two clubs. Like, they're only separated by, I want to say, 10 to 15 yards between mm-hmm. the two benches. And so when you've got that tension kind of building like a pressure cooker, eventually it spills over. Whereas even if the players are entering and exiting through the same hallway, if they're on opposite sides of the field, the pressure cooker maybe never gets to that temperature, because the temperature can kind of come down where it's like, oh, you know, somebody says something on the field and you throw a shove and temperature, and then it dissipates. Then you go, okay, maybe I overreacted. I think we've all in our lives had those circumstances. I know certainly I have, where you break apart and you go, okay, hold on. Now that I've had a chance to calm down, maybe my emotions got the better of me a little bit. Certainly that happens at the professional football level. So I agree. Optimally, you'd always have teams on opposite sides of the field. I believe currently the only places where that happens are on the prairies. It's Edmonton, Calgary, Saskatchewan, Winnipeg. The other five are all on the same side of the field, which I agree is suboptimal.
Both of the CFL's Alberta-based teams got upset wins in Week 5 as the Calgary Stampeders knocked off Winnipeg on Thursday in the first ever Stampede Bowl, and the Edmonton Elks beat Ottawa on Sunday at Commonwealth Stadium. Which of these was the more impressive win, Hodge?
Edmonton's win, very impressive. Trey Ford continues to improve. 15 of 17. I mean, that type of accuracy, you can't argue with. He's making the simple throws that the defense is giving him. They're spreading everybody out. The offensive line is firing off the ball. Justin Rankin, over 100 yards and a touchdown. The return game got going. Defensively, it was their best game. But the answer here is obviously the Calgary Stampeders. Right. This was not just a win for the Stampeders. This was a statement, right? This team was 2-1 to start the year. I think a little better than everybody kind of anticipated. But you also look at their schedule, was not, they didn't play a lot of vaunted opponents. Heck, they lost to the Ottawa Redblacks starting Dustin Crum at home, which is not a good loss. But to come out here and not just beat the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, but to step on the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and squish them into the dirt is, to me, easily, by far and away, the most impressive win any team has had in the CFL this season. The Stampeders came out firing on all cylinders. Offensively, they made it look easy. They had receivers in space. Vernon Adams Jr. moved the pocket. The offensive line controlled the line of scrimmage. The Bombers were unable to get any pressure with four. Defensively, they were swarming. Damon Webb, great pick early on in that game. The second half was not compelling to me whatsoever. It was basically the Bombers running Skelly for 30 minutes and Zach Kolaris throwing 8-yard hook routes, because that's just what the Stampeders willing to give them. So the second half is whatever. But the first half of this game was the most impressive performance I've seen from a CFL team this season, dare I say, for the last couple of seasons. The Calgary Stampeders, in my book, have gone from, you know, kind of a plucky team that's getting off the mat and we'll see what happens, to, oh, this is a team that is for real. I'm not saying they're going to win the West Division. I'm not saying that they are the team to beat in the CFL right now. But what I am saying is they are for real, and they are showing that we should have all bought into them a little sooner. I think the media as a whole was justified in maybe being skeptical about this team, given how poorly they finished last season, given their struggles even dating back to 2023. But this team looks real. This win was a three-phase win. It was an impressive win. They played fast. They played physical. They kicked Winnipeg's butt, and that is not easy to do. So full credit to the Stampeders. That was the most impressive win, again, not just this week, this season.
I agree with everything you said there, Hodge. And it's not just that the Stampeders won, it's who they won against and the fashion with which they won, because beating Winnipeg dominantly, as they did, proves you can play with the big boys, right? That was the question about the Stampeders first through the first 2 weeks, and I give them a lot of grace for that loss to Ottawa, considering the conditions that they were playing in. That was suboptimal with the wind and the rain, but you didn't necessarily give them full credit for their victories either, because it didn't come against the strongest opponents. Well, now you've beat an undefeated Winnipeg team, and you've beat them by a wide margin right off the bat, controlling the pace of that game, moving the ball at will. Dedrick Mills looked great in the backfield. Vernon Adams Jr., a couple of great touchdown passes in that game, wins the MVP of the inaugural Stampede Bowl. And even with some of the concerns I have at the linebacking core, even as they're getting better with Kyle Wilson and Adam Big Hill being added to that group, you start to see a team that can contend emerge, right? And that's a big improvement from where we saw the Stampeders just a year ago when they were last in the CFL. And you and I were both on this podcast talking about sort of the end of an era and the decline of the Stampeders organization. They've done a great job this offseason and this season thus far to pick themselves up off the mat. So kudos to them. But the Edmonton Elks, you have to be really, really pleased if you're a fan of the green and gold with that performance, specifically on offense, because we've talked a lot about sort of the struggles of Trey Ford to adapt to Jordan Maksimek's offense. Well, for the second straight week, he looked comfortable in the pocket. He had a perfect passer rating in that game. And perhaps more importantly, Hodge, they got the run game going. Justin Rankin looked like a monster in that game, which I think we all expected from him starting the season, but we hadn't seen it yet. I think that gives you a lot of confidence if you're a fan of the Edmonton Elks that they're about to turn the corner.
Yes, I do think that the Elks, this was their most impressive game for sure. We're going to talk about them a little bit more later on in the show. I mean, defensively, there are still some concerns for me, but I liked how physical their secondary was. I thought their defensive line, for kind of the first time this season, was starting to look like a unit that was the highest paid of the CFL, right? They did not look like that at all through their first three games. And then offensively, they're protecting the ball, right? That's the biggest and most important thing. Trey Ford is not going to ever be that guy who is slinging it, you know, 30, 40, 50 yards down the field consistently. He had some long completions, right? He had the 45-yarder to Justin Rankin. He had the 46-yarder to Javon Leak. The Leak throw was actually far downfield. Heck of a play by Leak to bring that in. But the Rankin one is a perfect example of how a Trey Ford offense should be moving the ball down the field, which is Trey Ford buying time with his unbelievable athleticism, flicking the ball into the air, right? A lob pass on a screen to Justin Rankin. And then holy smokes, like that Edmonton offense makes you cover 65 yards from sideline to sideline. Absolutely, they're going to make you run all day. And I think that's part of the reason why the Elks have had so much success, especially lately, running late in games, is these defenses are just exhausted, right? Like chasing Trey Ford around. It's like when the ping pong ball flies off the table and you have to run around like a chicken with its head cut off trying to grab it. Like, that's what it looks like trying to defend Trey Ford. And kudos, yes, I think the Elks are starting to put this together. Congratulations to Mark Killam, his first win as a CFL head coach. Also, full disclosure, I was at my parents' house yesterday watching this game, and when they doused Mark Killam in Gatorade, my mother said the sentence, "I hate it when they pour juice on coaches." And I thought that that was maybe the funniest thing I've ever heard anybody say. When I explained that it was Gatorade and not juice, she insisted, and I quote, "Gatorade is juice," which, again, wild take, but shout out to Baba Hogg. She's been watching the CFL since she was a kid, and without her fandom, I don't think I would be doing what I'm doing these days. So, and hopefully Mark Killam's hair was not too sticky after he was doused in Gatorade / juice.
Well, it's impressive hair, Hodge. I was a little concerned. I'm like, get that man to the locker room. He needs some olive oil gel, whatever he does, whatever his routine is. It's clearly working. He's got some of the best locks in the CFL.
Yes.
I don't know if Gatorade's good for the hair care.
That might be a Three Down Nation off-season article we have to write. CFL head coaches ranked by hair. And I think the first spot is probably not up for grabs. I agree with you. It's going to Mark Killam. After that,
it's a race to the bottom.
Yeah, there'd be a big drop off between one and two. And for the record, on the Three Down Nation podcast rankings, it would definitely be Justin Dunk one, JC Abbott two, John Hodge three. Though I guess we'd have to declare whether or not it's facial hair included. If it's facial hair included,
I think
my chances go up. If it's not included, then yeah, it's definitely a race to the bottom for me. But regardless, credit. And by the way, I'll say this too. The best thing, the biggest winner this entire weekend was the CFL itself. Mm-hmm. The Montreal Alouettes 2 weeks ago, and we'll talk about them a little bit later on, looked like they were going to rip their way to 5-0 and they would clinch the East Division by Labor Day. And in the West Division, like, yeah, it's interesting to watch Winnipeg and Sask go undefeated. But at that, then all you're doing is you're racing to see who maybe gets that third playoff spot in the West, be it Calgary, be it Edmonton, be it BC, whatever. With Winnipeg losing, the Alouettes losing two in a row, the Hamilton Tiger Cats getting off the mat, the Stamps getting a really good win, the Edmonton Elks winning at home, the CFL was a huge winner this week. The CFL wants parity. The CFL wants storylines. And I'm sorry, two or three teams just beating up everybody and clinching everything is not a compelling storyline. So I thought the biggest winner of this entire week and the last couple weeks really has been the CFL. We've got more parity in the CFL, which is what we thought we'd have coming into the season. It looks like we're actually going to get it. The Toronto Argonauts are heading into their bye week 1-4 and ninth on Three Down Nation's power rankings, while the Red Blacks, also 1-4, are only one spot above them. Should either team be pressing the panic button, JC?
I will say no for the Toronto Argonauts, because as much as we've bemoaned the amount of injuries that they are dealing with at this point, they still have one big trump card to play, and that's the return of Chad Kelly. They're saying he's out until week 7. Maybe he returns after the bye. That's a big boost for that team to get one of the top three quarterbacks in the league back on the field. That could change the narrative around this team entirely. And also, they ran into a buzzsaw this week. Let's be honest, Hodge, because that Hamilton offense was clicking at a level that I have not seen in a long time. And Toronto decided to match up one-on-one with Kenny Lawler for some inexplicable reason, and that was just not going to work. And by the time they realized it wasn't going to work, it was already too late because he'd scored long touchdowns on the first two throws of the game for the Ticats. So I give them a little grace there, and I know there's improvement coming around the corner. But for Ottawa, I mean, you got Drew Brown back in this game. That was supposed to be your trump card, right? That was supposed to explain away the losses that you've suffered. It was that you didn't have your starting quarterback, and then you can't get it done against Edmonton. That's seriously concerning for a team that I thought was going to be a contender in the East Division. I had them in the Grey Cup game, Hodge, preseason. I was that high on the Ottawa Redblacks, and it just hasn't looked that way thus far. They get one win against the Calgary Stampeders in terrible conditions. I don't think you can give them full credit for that victory because of how that game was played and the elements it was in. And so you look at the rest of it, and you have to be worried about the state of this team and why they have not been able to get that offense playing at a high level, why they haven't been able to get that pass rush going at a high level with Lorenzo Maldon and Bryce Carter on the outsides. Like, there's some serious flaws right now in the way they're playing the game, despite the fact that I think they have really good talent.
I don't think either of these teams need to be pressing the panic button. It's early in the CFL season. And again, it doesn't look like the Montreal Alouettes are 17 levels above everyone else in the East Division, which after the first 3 weeks, it certainly did. That said, I don't think either of these teams have a lot of string left, if that makes sense. I think this bye is well-timed for both of them. Let me say that again. The Argonauts are on a bye. I think this is well-timed for them, right? It's giving, hopefully, for their sake, Chad Kelly another week to get ready to go. I don't know if Chad Kelly is the silver bullet, right? This team has so many other injuries. That being said, if they can get Chad Kelly and Wynton McManus back, they've got some other pieces that are banged up. But to me, those are their two best players. I've said it before on the show. I'll say it again. To me, Wynton McManus is the best defensive player in the CFL, and Chad Kelly is a top three quarterback. So if you add those two guys into the mix, that alone, I think, makes you a heck of a lot better. The problem is they're going into a bye. A very pissed off Alouettes team is going on the bye, and that's the team that they play when they get back in week 7. And it doesn't get any easier than that if they're Toronto Argonauts. You've got the Montreal Alouettes in week 7. Week 8, you've got Winnipeg. And then week 9, you go to Winnipeg. So your next 3 games are against arguably the two best teams in the CFL. Now, I know the Alouettes have lost 2 in a row. The Bombers just got blasted in Calgary. I'm not discrediting that whatsoever. But these are still 2 very good teams, right? And so if you're the Argonauts, I think a win at this point would be getting 2 of those games. I don't think you can realistically win all 3. If you go 1-2, that's probably not a disaster. That gets you to 2-6. But if you don't win any, like, that would be a massive smash the panic button situation. Staring 1-7 down a barrel, not fun. So I don't think the Argonauts need to press the panic button yet, but I think they've kind of played out their string. Ottawa, I was looking at their schedule. Their challenge is they only play the Argonauts twice, and they've already lost once, and they lost that game by 12 points. So the Red Blacks are going to have a hard time getting that season series on Toronto. They play one another, by the way, for the second and final time in week 10. If the Red Blacks win that game by more than 12 points, they would get the season series. If they win it by less than that, or they tie or lose, they would lose the season series. That is not optimal when it looks like these two teams might be battling it out for a playoff spot in the East Division. The nice thing for the Red Blacks is their schedule, I'm not going to say it's soft, but it's at least a little softer than Toronto. They've got a home and home with the Tiger Cats coming up. Yes, the Tabbies looked incredible in week 5. Kenny Lawler does that usually once or twice a year where he just says to everybody, F you, I'm Kenny Lawler, and makes every play. And that's why he is such a dominant player. He doesn't necessarily always do it consistently, right? Week 1, the connection between him and Bo was like pickles in a Pop-Tart. It was terrible. This past week, it was unbelievable. Their synergy, the way that they were able to play together, like that chemistry was 1,000% on point, which was so much fun to watch. So if you are the Red Blacks, I think the positives are, okay, Drew Brown's back. He had another 300-yard game. Granted, did not play brilliantly in Edmonton, but he certainly I thought for his first game in a month, looked pretty good. The receiving core is great. Khalil Pimpleton, sucks to lose Devontae Dedmon. We'll talk about that in 3-minute drill. But Khalil Pimpleton is a fantastic second choice there. The offensive line, it looks like they're going to get Peter Godber back soon. It looks like they're going to get Zach Pelios back soon. I think that will fix their issues there. The secondary to me has been disappointing. I expected big things from Robert Priester, Amari Henderson. They brought him in, I think, as a bit of a reclamation project after a tough season in Saskatchewan. I'm not sure that's worked out super well in the secondary. But regardless, like Toronto, this is not a team that has to panic to me. But the string is getting short. Like, you cannot go into Hamilton this week and get your butt whipped. You need to figure this out, because 1-4 is an okay place to start. You're only 4 points back of first place in the East Division. But you have to start turning it around soon, or I think fans will become impatient. The Red Blacks, yes, got back to the playoffs last season. It was a great story. But I don't think fans are going to be satisfied starting the next year 1-5, or dare I say 1-6.
First of all, Hunch, we may need a fact check here. Are pickles and Pop-Tarts a bad combination? They might be one of those, like, salty sweet things that's actually, like,
pregnant women may disagree with me, but I think most people would find that combination to be disgusting, which is why
we need to
I said
eat
it.
Pickles and Pop-Tarts on the podcast and let people know.
Well, you have eaten an entire raw onion on the podcast. For the record, I really like pickles. I don't particularly like Pop-Tarts. To me, they taste like chemicals and sadness. But I don't think that adding a pickle would enhance the flavor. I think it would make it worse. But who knows? Let us know in the comments or on social media. Have you ever tasted pickles and Pop-Tarts mixed together? If so, please report back.
The one thing I'll add to that equation about the Ottawa Redblacks is I was concerned with how they ended that game against Edmonton, because they had a chance to win it late, right? They were within a score, and I just didn't see any urgency on that final drive, a lack of clock management, a lack of belief. I don't know what exactly it was, but I thought Bob Dice and Tommy Condell and that offense could have done better jobs collectively at maximizing the time they had to mount a comeback, because it was not impossible, but it seemed like they made it so, right? They didn't score until there were 10 seconds left and then finally attempted the onside kick. They had plenty of time on that final drive. And I think that's something that will have to be addressed internally for that organization going into next week. Because if you're going to be in these tight games, you can't afford to make those small mistakes that have seconds ticking off the clock that ultimately will cost you. The CFL has a truncated slate in week 6 as Toronto, Winnipeg, and Montreal will all be on a bye. Of the 3 upcoming games, which one are you most looking forward to and why?
First of all, 3-week games, or three game weeks, I should say, are lame. I appreciate that they might be a necessary devil with the weirdness that comes with a 9-team league. But can we please get to team 10? Like, please, I'll be the first one to throw in $50 for the Atlantic Schooners. I want one share. That's
apparently
fine.
They're not going to refund you if you...
Yeah, I know.
If you give them $50.
Which is fair. I get it. But still, like, I can't wait. Hopefully, I'll say when, not if. Hopefully when, fingers crossed, this becomes a 10-team league. We can have 3 weeks of the season, like the game, 19 weeks of the regular season, everybody gets one bye, and slap dab in the middle, like weeks 8, 9, and 10, you can have as 4 game weeks. In other words, 2 teams get the bye, and then that's all. I guess that math doesn't work. You would need a few more, but regardless, I'm looking forward to a time when most weeks have 10 games, or 10 teams playing 5 games. And then a few times we could just have 4 games, but whatever. To me, the answer is very obvious. No disrespect to Ottawa at Hamilton or BC at Edmonton. The answer is very, very clearly Calgary at Saskatchewan. You've got a hot Stampeders team, 3-1, a rejuvenated Stampeders team that's playing good football, going up against the last undefeated team in the CFL. And let's hope, JC, fingers crossed, we get a great crowd at Mosaic Stadium. The crowd, mm-hmm. I think, was a little better for their second game than their first game, but I want to see 30,000 plus for this one. And I know that, you know, when the season opener had a bit of a lousy crowd in Saskatchewan, it was like, oh, it's Thursday. It's like, okay, well, this is Friday, and you're undefeated, and you're hosting the second place team in the West Division, a rival. Like, let's bring it. Let's fill Mosaic. Let's have a great crowd. This should be a great game. Trevor Harris should return. I want to see it. I want to turn on Friday Night Football and be blown away by the atmosphere. Let's see it happen.
I'm generally a fan of more football, not less, but I have to disagree with you, Hodge. I actually enjoy the odd three-game week because I'm generally working the desk for all of these games every single weekend. And if there's a three-game week, I can say to my girlfriend, you know what? Tonight's just for you. Let's set aside work. And she's none the wiser. Hopefully she's not listening to this podcast. But it works out well. It works out well for old JC when we get the odd three-game week. I think you picked the correct game here, Hodge, in terms of Calgary and Saskatchewan. That has to be must-watch TV this weekend. But I'll go in a different direction because I think we're going to learn a lot from BC and Edmonton, right? These are two teams that played each other in the first week of the season. It was not particularly close. BC beat the brakes off of them. It was a great game from Nathan Rourke, but they've mostly struggled. Edmonton's now coming off their first win. Have they turned the corner? And is BC better now with Nathan Rourke, or are their flaws that hurt them when he wasn't in the lineup still going to be things that come back to bite them? I think it will be interesting to see how Edmonton responds with a victory under their belt and if BC can take the next step, because Rourke looked okay in that game, 352 yards passing, 43 on the ground. It's nothing to sneeze at, but his accuracy was a little off. You could see that the oblique injury was still bugging him a little bit. Is he going to be the full Rourke that we know and love that we saw in that first week? Or is Edmonton going to be able to get a little bit of revenge here? I think that'll be critical for determining the race for the back of the West Division, potentially that third spot for the playoffs or a potential crossover spot. These two teams need to prove something in this game.
Though this is the second meeting between BC and Edmonton this season, it is not the last one. There is a third and final meeting in week 20. So the season series, I guess, is technically up for grabs for BC. If they win this game, they clinch it. They'll have two of the three games. If Edmonton wins, this season series will still be up for grabs. And I agree, JC, this could be a season series that come the end of the season matters a lot, potentially, depending on how the West Division standings shake out. The CFL announced this past week that negotiation lists would permanently be made public. Each team can have 45 players on the list at any time, securing their exclusive rights should they choose to sign a CFL contract. With few exceptions, only non-draft eligible players with no previous CFL experience can be added. JC, is this a big deal, a little deal, or no deal?
I'm going to say it's a big deal, Hodge, because we have called for the negotiation lists to be public since I can remember, right? This is something that has always been super secret behind the scenes, behind the iron curtain, as it will, because teams did not want this information out to players and agents to call them on it. Well, because of that, we got a lack of fan engagement. And I think anytime you can get your fans or people who are interested in becoming fans thinking about more aspects of your game, talking about things more throughout the year, it's a good thing. And the negotiation list does that, because now at any point, as we get towards the college football season, as we get later in the year, fans can look and say, well, I should have my eye on this guy because he might be a Hamilton Tiger Cat next season. Or, wow, we're really weak at the running back position. I wonder if there's anybody on the neg list who might be available to come in right away. all of these questions now have answers. They can create discussion. They can create engagement. And they can engage audiences on the other side of the border as well, Hodge. It's maybe not quite as exciting as a brawl, which you believe would attract some fan eyeballs up here. But when they see that a big name like Shedeur Sanders is on the neg list, and it's not just a report from somebody at TSN or at Three Down Nation that they've never heard of before, well, they're seeing it on an actual physical list provided by the league. I think there's more likely to be more stories as a result of that. We've seen that this week with some of the big names on the neg list, and that's only going to grow going forward.
I respectfully disagree with you, JC. I knew, by the way, I was like, I bet my house JC was going to say this is a big deal because you are such a football nerd. I certainly don't think this is no deal. This is a step in the right direction for the CFL. Transparency is good. I know that that is something that new commissioner, CFL Commissioner Stuart Johnston, wants to work towards, is transparency as much and as often as possible, which I think is very smart. I think is great. I think it's a win for fans. I think it's a win for media. I think it's a win for the league, everybody. But, and there's a but here. This is a list of essentially 400 players. Of whom, or close to 500 players even. And nobody has ever heard of 95% of them. And I don't want to discredit these players, some of whom will be CFL stars one day, and who are very good collegiate players, or in some cases, you know, solid NFL players, whatever. But like, I brought up the neg list in front of me, you know, BC Lions, for instance. I've got it open just because that's the first one on the list. It's like, oh, I don't know how many fans in the province of British Columbia are going like, oh, thank goodness we have the rights to Bradley Ane, defensive lineman out of the University of Utah. Hey,
Bradley Ane was a pretty good college player. I think he was an All-American, wasn't he?
I'm saying how many fans are sitting at home going, well, thank goodness, like this is a revolutionary thing that I know this now. Ben DiNucci is a name that some fans might recognize. He is a quarterback. He's played in and out of the NFL for a number of years. I believe led the XFL in passing yardage in 2023. Outside of that, I don't know if there's a player on the entire list who you would know. And I only say that, I'm not trying to be a hater, I'm just saying it because the thought that this list is going to take fan engagement to an all new level, like I think that would be very hyperbolic for anybody to suggest. Is this a step in the right direction? Yes. I don't think it's a revolution. I think it's a small step. I think it's a little deal. It's a positive step. It's good, but this is not going to overnight revolutionize or change anything. One thing I will say is I reached out to the league and I said, you know what? This tracker is good. I like it. One helpful thing would be, because by the way, when you get an actual copy of the negotiation list, it always has a date beside the name of each player as to when they were added. And I said, I would love it if that column was back in place. And I said, because currently that's not online. And then I said, and also it'd be really nice if any player who was added, let's say within a week or 10 days or something, had like a highlight. So in other words, if you go to the neg list and there's, you know, a name that's listed in like highlighter yellow, you know, that kind of draws your eye and you go, oh, look, this player was just added in the last 3 days or whatever. I said, I think those would be positive changes. And a league spokesperson told me that those changes are in fact planned and coming and should be up even within a week or two. They just wanted to get the initial kind of inaugural announcement out, and those little bells and whistles will be added later. So if you're looking at the neg list going, wow, this is very overwhelming, I don't even know who these players are, but this is a list you might as a fan want to come back to every few weeks and see what kind of new players have been added. That apparently is coming, which I do think is, again, a nice small plus for members of the media, for fans who are interested in this. But again, I'm skeptical that this is going to revolutionize CFL interest.
For the record, you're not a huge college football watcher. So
no, I fully acknowledge and admit that.
So the fact that you don't necessarily recognize a ton of players on this list, and not all of them are household names, that's part of the reason. If you are a college football fan, and I think when we're talking about engagement from south of the border, more people are. It's not as big a deal in Canada. there's going to be more names that people recognize or are familiar with. In terms of a Canadian fan who doesn't follow college football, I think what it gives you is an avenue for research, right? And maybe I am just, as you put it, Hodge, a football nerd. But when I see a name that I don't recognize, I am Googling him and looking up highlights and doing everything to try and figure out who this guy is and how he might fit into the CFL. I hope there are more fans out there that are doing something similar. And even if it's just a handful, this gives them the avenue to do that. The one change I would make to how it's presented and disseminated would be that you have something, maybe just even on the transaction wire, where when there is a new name added or a guy removed from the neg list, it shows up there. So you can easily track it. Right now, you just have to look at a list of 45 names and hopefully with dates added, look through and see, okay, oh, looks like this guy is a recent addition, or, you know, compare it to the previous list. That's not a particularly streamlined way to learn about changes to the neg list. If you're going to do this, let's have it on the transaction wire or have a separate list where you can see those changes by the day as they happen.
And yes, there are some guys on here who I'm sure hardcore football fans would know. And again, a lot of them are quarterbacks, but, you know, guys who play at LSU, right? Or who play at Miami, Florida State, right? These are guys who you might pay attention to. Looking at Edmonton's negotiation list right now, they've got a Northern Colorado guy. Not sure how many Canadians are really dialed into Northern Colorado football. The same would be true for Joey Fisher, an offensive lineman out of Shepherd University, a school that I dare say nobody actually knows where it is. Even those who attend Shepherd University, it just exists in the void somewhere.
Isn't it in West Virginia?
I'm sure you would know that. I don't know. Gardner Webb, North Dakota State. North Dakota State's produced some very good football players, but again, I don't know how many Canadians are really dialed into that. Minnesota Duluth, Lindenwood College. I've heard of Lindenwood College. I don't know that many Canadians are, again, super dialed in watching every Lindenwood College football game.
Joey Fisher is in his third NFL season as an undrafted free agent. He's been with five different teams.
And that's great. And again, a lot of these guys are not in college anymore. But the reason I say that is because you specifically said, well, there are college football fans who know these things. And again, I'm not entirely disagreeing. There is some accuracy to that. But like, especially when you get into like some of the D2 guys, the NAIA, it it's dubious at best is my point. But regardless, again, I think we agree this is positive. I think you think it's super positive. I think it's merely positive. I think it's, a small step in the right direction.
There's an NFL quarterback from Shepherd University, Hodge. Tyson Bajan. Come on now. Don't disrespect the Rams.
Fair. And I will say one other thing is that the college thing is almost a farce now in the transfer portal era, right? Because it used to be that when you came from a college that meant something. That was like, oh, you played there for 3 to 5 years. Like that's a big deal. Whereas nowadays it's like, well, you play your first season at this school, and if it doesn't work out, you go D2, you keep your eligibility, and then you go to this school and you go to that school. So you might have, you know, be a product of whatever LSU, but it's like, well, you played for five schools before that, and you know, so it's a bit of a farce anyway. So fair point.
Hodge just hates college football.
I don't hate college football. And as you said, this is a pass rusher who's bounced around five different NFL teams. And that's great.
Offensive
Everybody's
lineman,
heard of those
Hodge.
NFL.
Come on now.
Oh, offensive lineman, regardless. But my point is, how many CFL fans know of this backup offensive lineman who's bounced between five NFL teams? The answer is nobody.
Well, if you're a team that has a lot of pressure off the edge, maybe you should learn about him. Figure out if he's any good.
Fair, though, as we've talked about recently, JC, none of these American offensive linemen are tackles. They're guards who will be moving to tackle.
I think this is an exception to that current trend, and that's because he's on the D2 level.
Well, maybe we should do a new segment on the podcast. We've got Hodges Heritage Moment. Maybe the new segment should be JC's Random Neglister. And you pick a random guy and tell us about him. I think that might be interesting. And if you think that would be interesting, please drop a comment or let us know on social media.
Would JC's first one, Random Neglister. Levi Bell. That's number one on my list. Defensive lineman at Texas State on the Saskatchewan Roughriders neg list. This kid's a D tackle. He's like 5'9 playing D tackle.
5'9.
I saw him at the College Gridiron Showcase. This dude, man, one of the strongest, best players I've ever seen in person. He's been bouncing around the NFL and the UFL for the last couple years. Rips it up in preseason, but nobody wants to give him a shot because he's so small. He's built for the CFL game, man. He's got to come up here at some point.
Do we know how tall Jerome Haywood is?
Jerome Haywood.
Do you not remember Jerome Haywood?
I do remember. I don't remember how tall he is, though.
Jerome Haywood played mostly in Ottawa, but he finishes. Yeah, okay, I've just Googled him. Okay, he was listed at 5'9", according to his CFL card. Wikipedia has him at 5'8". So I'm wondering if Jerome Haywood is the shortest defensive tackle in the modern CFL. Maybe this kid, Levi Bell, would give him a run for his money.
He's the highest graded defensive tackle in college football his senior year by PFF, despite being 5'9". That's amazing. Stud.
The fact that he's gotten signed in the NFL at 5'9" as an interior
defender. He had multiple sacks in the preseason with the Seahawks.
Yeah, like you have to be a sensational player to get even signed at that height. For the record, Jerome Haywood does not have an official listing on Draft Scout, which I think is the consensus most reliable online source of information for pro day results. So regardless, if people want the segment, we can do it. For now, it's Hodges Heritage Moment. On this day in 2012, Larry Taylor recorded 428 kick return yards for the Calgary Stampeders in a 39-36 loss to the Toronto Argonauts. It was the most kick return yardage ever recorded in a CFL game, and it's not that close, JC. I don't think anybody has more than 400. What do you remember of Larry Taylor?
Oh, he was an electric player for the Alouettes. And later the Stampeders, always a threat to score. One of those great returners of my childhood, Hodge, a guy I used to love watching. What I wonder is, how many kick return yards do you think you could get at a CFL game?
How many reps am I getting? How many shots?
Let's say it's a blowout. You're getting 10. 10 kickoff returns. How many yards you getting?
Here's the biggest challenge. I would have a hard time fielding the ball, right? Like, that's just not a skill set I've ever developed. So I don't think it's a guarantee I'm going to catch even like half of them. Like, fielding a kickoff is not easy. If hypothetically I were to catch them all and they were actually hit deep, I'm optimistic I could get like 10 yards a rep. So I'd say 100. But again, I don't actually think I would be able to catch them all. So if I were to catch three, let's say, I would set my over-under at like 30, like 10 yards per, and I'd catch about 3 out of 10. What do you think you could do?
I think that's highly optimistic. I'm going for negative 10 yards overall with 7 fumbles for myself.
Keep in mind that when you catch, like assuming the kick is a true kickoff, you usually get the first 10 yards for free. This isn't like a punt where you can field it and you've already got multiple defenders at the 5-yard halo. This is a situation where you've got free yards. Like, it's free real estate.
I think most CFL players can cover 10 yards faster than I can take a step.
That might be true. Regardless, we would both be terrible and are much better suited to other positions. There's a reason I was never a kick returner back when I used to play.
I actually briefly was, Hodge, which was a terrible decision by my Pee Wee coaches. Horrible. Oh, yes.
I was going to say, that probably says more about the team as a whole than you as an individual.
It was back in the day when you had mandatory 10 plays in Pee Wee football. Like, I was the younger age group my first season. They're like, we got to find a way to get him on the field. Let's get him to return a punt. It was not a good decision.
The thought that you have to arbitrarily get a guy on the field for 10 plays and your choice is to ensure he gets the ball in his hands is a wild choice.
Wild.
That's sort of like a Make-A-Wish kid moment when I got the ball in sports.
There you go. It's that time for the three-minute drill. Red Blacks returner Devontae Dedmon was carted off the field during Sunday's game at Edmonton. Do you think the injury looked season-ending?
Yeah, unfortunately, that looked like it was either a broken ankle or something of that ilk. I don't think he'll be back this year. Fortunately for Ottawa, they've got a pretty good backup returner in Khalil Pimpleton, who's also a hell of a receiver. Took back a 97-yard punt return in that game. I think they're going to be okay at that position. Sean Lemon can officially apply for CFL reinstatement as of July 4th, our own Justin Dunk has reported. Do you think he'll be back in the league this year?
I do, and I think it's going to be with the Montreal Alouettes. The Canadian men's senior tackle football team will face Team Germany in November. Do you expect they'll win that game?
I do expect that they'll win that game, but it's not going to be the blowout like we saw against Team Italy. First of all, they weren't even facing the best version of Team Italy in that game, which they won 56-0. Germany is better than Italy, and I think they will be bringing their A squad for this game against Team Canada. Roy Leister won the Save on Foods touchdown to win on Saturday when Janarian Grant and Isaiah Wooden returned kickoffs for touchdowns in the same game. Does Leister owe Grant and Wooden any part of that $1 million for helping him win?
Well, it is $50,000 a year for the next 20 years, so it's not like he's got $1 million liquid cash. That said, if I'm Leister, I think you certainly have to do something. Write it, and maybe you can ask for something back. You know, it's like, hey, I want a signed Janarian Grant. I want a signed Isaiah Wooden jersey. And, you know, I'll give them both $500 or whatever. I think that would be a nice show from Mr. Leister. And by the way, I know Leister lives in BC. I'm in Manitoba. But hit me up. I want some groceries. That would be awesome if you're a Three Down Nation fan.
Yep, I want some groceries.
Groceries are awesome, and they're very expensive, so I would like some groceries. Former Ottawa Rough Riders general manager Joanne Pollock is the new chairperson on the board of Football Canada. Was she the right pick?
I think she's a fantastic selection for this job. Has been involved in football at the highest level, is clearly adept in a boardroom. I think she'll do great for football in this country. Canadian receiver Chase Claypool revealed that he missed the entire 2024 season due to a torn ligament and tendon in his toe. Now healthy, do you think the 27-year-old will get an NFL shot in 2024?
I'd like to see him get a shot. Granted, it's Claypool himself saying it, but he said he worked his way up the depth chart in Buffalo. I think we all know what you meant. But this is also a guy who I think developed a little bit of a reputation for being maybe a little bit of a diva, maybe being a little bit of, I don't want to say a personality problem, but maybe being a little bit dramatic. And therefore, I think that might keep him out a little bit. That said, it's inevitable that at some point an NFL team, just like Buffalo last year, is going to get banged up at the position. They're going to need somebody. And what Chase Claypool did as an NFL rookie should not be understated. Like, this guy was the first read in the red zone, often for Ben Roethlisberger, double-digit touchdowns. There are lots of, like, amazing Hall of Fame NFL receivers who did not have double-digit touchdowns as rookies. So I think that Chase Claypool certainly deserves another shot. Who knows, though? Maybe he'll end up with the Saskatchewan Roughriders. He's, of course, on their negotiation list. There you go. For JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We will join you Wednesday for our Week 6 CFL picks. Until then, we'll see ya.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.